It's now 8 o'clock, time for this morning's talk. The whole family there. So even with little teddy bears, sometimes it does give us a sense of happiness and joy, a bit of fun, which in some meditation retreats they didn't have any fun. It was all so serious. And sometimes when it gets serious, too serious, people get so tight. And of course that's the opposite of learning how to let go. And so sometimes just letting things be relaxing, just that is a fast way to get the mind to be peaceful. Sometimes in life, can be quite tough. Many things to do, problems to solve, places to be. And sometimes that it's if we don't have the fun there, then of course it misses so much. Ajahn Chah, he was just such an amazing person to be with, simply because that he was, he always tended to see things in a totally different way, and some of the things which he would do and say to solve big problems was just amazingly funny. But it wasn't just a case of joy for the sake of just wasting time. It was always like funny stories which made you realize that sometimes the Dhamma, the truth, seeing things deeply, is like laughing at our silly human condition. And just thinking of one of Ajahn Chah's funny stories, I've already mentioned the one about the Swedish professor and what meditation is all about. But this was almost, not quite a personal story, but I was there when this happened, when there was Ajahn Chah was going into a town to go to the railway station. He had his Thai driver, and he had myself in the back seat, together with a monk called Gary, together with this monk who was a translator. And halfway on the journey, Ajahn Chah turned around to this poor novice monk, Gary, and said, "You're thinking of your girlfriend back in Los Angeles. He's only just become a novice." And this poor monk was totally busted, because that's what he was doing. You had to be very careful of what you were thinking in your mind when Ajahn Chah was around. So, you know, he read the mind, and poor old Gary, just in front of everybody, was embarrassed. And it was at that point that Ajahn Chah showed his amazing compassion. He said to this young novice, he said, "Well, we can help you there. I know how hard it is to leave your loved ones in another country. So next time you write to her, ask her to send you something of hers, something personal. So when you miss her, you can take that out to remember your girlfriend and not feel so separated." And when that went through the translator, even I was surprised. Is that allowable for a monk to do things like that? You know, to take a lock of her hair or a piece of her dress with her scent on it. Is that proper? And I just said, "Oh yeah, you can do that," he said. And of course, over the years, you know, Ajahn Chah was up to something again. And then when Ajahn Chah responded what to ask her for, the poor translator was just laughing and crying. And we wondered what on earth Ajahn Chah had said. It took a long time for him to calm down. Until he said, next time you write to your girlfriend in Los Angeles, ask her to send her a little bottle, to send you back a little bottle in which you put some of her shit." And so whenever you miss your girlfriend, take off. That's my girlfriend back in Los Angeles. Well, it's personal. And it's, don't you actually, when you fall in love, you say, I love everything about you, my dear. Not quite. And that's not gender specific. If you want to ask anything of your boyfriends, you can ask them for that. Ajahn Chah was just sometimes to say that when we think about someone we like, we always think about their good qualities. And if you want to sort of balance that, you know, you think of some of their bad qualities. So that, in other words, they're not so perfect. Which means that you can have an even-minded picture of those people, sometimes which arouse aversion in us, and sometimes those people arouse lust in us. Just human beings, that's all. So if you want to develop that equanimity, that if there's some boyfriend or person you really, really, really want, then just ask her for someone for... Because that's part of everybody, the nice part and the ugly part. But that was Ajahn Chah just giving us, it was actually, if anyone wishes to see that, understand that, that's actually almost like part of the adaptation from the suttas, Vitakka Santana Sutta, the way to overcome sort of distracting thoughts by balancing them. It's like almost sense restraint. If you see something you like, see something in it which is not so, you know, helpful. If those of you who really get into food and you eat too much, then how can you look at the food to get a balanced attitude towards food? So one of the things which I practiced and taught for a while is that whenever you see the food, it's really nice and delicious, it's just the sort of food you like, but then when you're looking at it on your plate, always remember that what comes out the other end, you know, is brown and sticky, and that must have been in the food there somewhere. It didn't come from outside. So, you know, the beautiful rice or tofu or curry, whatever, so you look inside there, it's somewhere in there, in that food, you know, must be this brown stuff. It's all sort of hidden somewhere. Because that's what I'm eating. I'm eating sort of, you know, the excrement, but mixed with other things as well. And so my body takes the good stuff out, and that's what's left. It must be in there somewhere. So, when you look at your lunch today, see if you can see it in there somewhere. That's only if you indulge. But, you know, if you just, you know, find it difficult to find something to eat, don't do that. Otherwise, you'll start to suffer from anorexia. You know, that's actually, I found out, that's my disease. Of course it is. I looked in the dictionary one day and said, what is anorexia? And the definition is that you look in the mirror and you think you're fat. That's me. Describes me perfectly. Now, one of some of the reasons I do this humour stuff, just like Ajahn Chah, is because once you have a bit of humour coming in, you're laughing. Physically, it enhances your immune system, it makes you light, you want to be in the present moment when you're laughing. It actually brings you into here and now, which is one of the reasons why, that if we make a little bit of fun and joy and inspiration even, that really gets you into this present moment. Which is one of the reasons why, this is where we start our meditation, this is where mindfulness comes from. When we're negative, life gets so difficult. When I was a student, I was just stupid, hairy, like my sort of alcohol in those days. And when you went to Cambridge and you found out that they had these little launches of societies and they had free free sherry. And really good stuff, not rubbish stuff, really nice stuff, all for free. So on one occasion I went to the college boat club, just for the sherry. That's all. No intention of signing up and actually doing anything physical. But I must have had too many glasses, because then I found out I joined up. So you had to do something physical, like, you know, rowing in a boat. I thought, that's not bad, just, you know, after just rowing along, watching the scenery. But no, this was serious stuff. They were racing. I just can't understand why people race. Even when you go around racing around a track, like running, you only go round and round, you end up where you started. What's the point? And in the school where I went to beforehand, they used to have cross-country running. But it wasn't cross-country because, you know, we were, you know, right in the middle of the city, next to the River Thames. So what we would do, we'd go to the nearest bridge, we'd run over that bridge, down the towpath to the next bridge upriver, cross that and run back to the school. You know, it took maybe an hour and a half. But I wasn't into that. We'd always end up where we started. So a few kids, you know, they just got off and they started riding when they're out of sight of the school. They just, you know, go to the coffee shop or just sit down, relax, and then, you know, cross the bridge back again and get a bit of a sweat up before they enter the school again. But the teachers soon caught on to that trick. So one of the teachers would drive up to the furthest bridge and sort of drop people's names down. So you had to get to the far bridge, you know, to show you got there. So then, of course, clever kids, we got the bus timetables. So we crossed the bridge, got the bus to the next bridge, crossed over, got our names ticked off, and we got the bus back again. That was not... Well, I did play soccer. I like playing soccer. But even there, it was just... It was crazy stuff. People actually played to win. I couldn't understand that. No, even to this day. The last game of soccer I ever played, it was, if you know soccer, it's 11 aside. Nine of the other team turned up, 11 of my team turned up, and it was some ridiculous score at half-time. It was so one-sided. And at the half-time, I went up to my captain and said, can I just play for the other side, second half? Make a game of it, even it out a bit. And he swore at me, well, you can't play for the opposition. Why not? I'm here for fun. I don't want to win. You know, what's the point of winning if there's no joy in it? And so, you know, he swore at me. And that was it. I never played again after that because I didn't really want to actually to just winning at all costs. Never made any sense to me. But anyway, there you were, just in a boat with, you know, seven other men just pulling this oar as fast as you could. And it was just really hurt. But the one thing I got out of that exercise, the only thing I ever learned, was when his coach was on the footpath in a bicycle and giving us instructions, you know, through a megaphone. And the coach looked at me, and because my name at those days was Peter, said, Peter, you're making an ugly face. Smile, for goodness sake. Can you imagine you do this? Of course it hurts. You are ugly. But then, you know, I was always willing to give things a try and follow instructions just to see if it worked or not. So I smiled. And that was the first time I realized that when you smile instead of grimacing, that the oar is much easier to pull. You have more energy and it doesn't hurt as much. You can more engage with the task instead of resisting it with your emotional negativity, which was manifested as the ugly face. And I thank that coach. That was, you know, worth all that sort of ridiculous exercises and training. But later on, you use that in your life as well. And of course, the next time which I noticed that was when you were a young monk in Thailand, going from place to place. And we used to be in the back of, like, what they call in Australia, a ute, a pickup truck, just in the tray in the back. The back tray did have a metal frame on the outside, and over which there was a tarpaulin stretched. So if it rained, you wouldn't get soaked. And that was the main form of transport, going from monastery to monastery for different events or ceremonies. But what happened was there was no sealed roads in that part of Thailand then, 45 years ago. So they're all dirt roads. And so if there was a rainstorm, they'd have potholes. And so even though there were potholes, the driver just didn't really worry. He was just trying to miss them, but often just hit the potholes. So you can imagine when the truck went down, I went up and cracked my head on the metal frameworks. And that really hurt. There's so many times you cracked your head. And if you're a lay person, at least you'd have what we call padding. Called hair. A bald head, no protection, crack. Oh. But what I did notice, which was weird, was when the Thai monks, when they cracked their head, they didn't swear, they laughed. And that's something which I could not understand. How come when it hurts, a person can laugh? And so I had my theories. My first theory was that those Thai monks had been traveling like that for much longer than I had. They probably cracked their heads so many times they were now brain damaged. I thought that. But then you'd been talking to these monks. They weren't brain damaged. They were very smart, smarter than I was. And so you realize that could not be the reason why they laughed when they hurt. And so I decided to try that. Next time I hit my head, I determined I was going to laugh instead of swear. And that's when you found out, amazing little piece of insight. If you laugh when you hit your head, it hurts much less. It does. And of course, if you don't believe me, come here. For some reason that when you laugh, you're not resisting, you're actually engaging with the feeling, it's not so bad. You're not adding the negative emotional feelings, you know, to the experience. And that is one of the reasons why we include laughter and smiling and kindness in our meditation practice. It means that you're engaging with this moment when you smile. It's one of the reasons why if you give a Dharma talk and you tell a few funny stories, people remember the funny stories. They don't remember all the Dharma in between. Sometimes they do. But it's the funny stories. Why is that? Because you can see your mindfulness increases. Your awareness increases. You're engaged with what's going on. And now when we get to the point of the breath, watching the breath. Why is it so hard to watch the breath? Why don't we engage much with it? Because again, we don't make it interesting. We don't even make it amusing. And so we don't think outside the box. And so, for many years, I was actually teaching new ways of doing breath meditation. And I will demonstrate them for you, because demonstration is brilliant. So don't need to change your posture, as you are. Just close your eyes, breathe in and out three times. At the end of the third breath, open your eyes. Just three breaths, count them. In, out, just after the end of the third breath, open your eyes. Okay, now, was that easy to do? Mm-hmm. Okay, now, I'm pretty sure, confident, that when I asked you to just three breaths and then open your eyes, you started off with the in-breath. In, out, in, out, in, out. Now, when I say close your eyes, start out with the out-breath. Breathe out first, then in. Out, in, out, in. Okay, so go, close your eyes. At the end of that third in-breath, open your eyes. Weird, but it's totally different. If you start with the out-breath and any in-breath, it's not the same. Should be, but it isn't. So that is why it's this new type of meditation developed here in China Grove called backwards breath meditation. Breathe out in, out in, out in. Now that's also showing you something. When you mess around and play around and make it interesting, you're engaging in it, then of course that boredom just disappears. And you're really sort of easy to be aware when it's a little bit interesting. So now, the third type of breath meditation is called, you know, the third type. It's three in-breaths to one out-breath. So when you mess around with these things, it makes it fun, joyful, not boring, and of course you do engage with what you're experiencing. That's the whole point of this. So that you can be watching your breath and do a little bit messing around with it. But to even go deeper, sometimes when you're watching your breath, breathing in, breathing out, breathing in, breathing out, if you've got enough mindfulness, in other words, your meditation is really going well, really strong, and you can watch the breath easily like that, it should be delightful anyway. But some of the other ways you can breathe the breath in, this is Ajahn Gunhar's method. Ajahn Gunhar was this really great monk, still alive, and he came here for one range retreat many years ago. And he was the monk who, if you don't know this story, he was in the jungle meditating with a lot of other monks. And that they heard a jungle animal come towards them. It must have been still light. And this wasn't a tiny mouse like what I made me open my eyes. This was a cobra, a king cobra, huge snake. And this king cobra in that part of Thailand had a nickname. This was locally known by the villagers as the one-step snake. And the reason it was called one-step snake was it was so venomous, if it bit you, that's all you had left of your life, one step, and you were dead. It's a pretty dangerous snake. So other monks also opened their eyes and they saw this actually happening. It was corroborated. This snake slithered up in front of Ajahn Gunhar, who was just sitting here. And the snake raised its head, opened its hood, right in front of Ajahn Chah's nose. Now, what would you do? First of all, forget about running. In my first year as a monk, there was this huge python who lived in the forest where I was. And I wasn't scared of the python when it was just caught up there, you know, because it's a very beautiful animal. But then it got scared of me, and what really made me afraid was how fast it could slide through the jungle. It was incredibly fast, a big animal like that. Fortunately, it was going in the opposite direction, not coming towards me. And I've seen that many times. Big snakes, they're very, very fast. They can certainly outrun me. Even in those days when I wasn't carrying so much handicap, as they say in the horse racing industry. But so you can't outrun those snakes. So there you are sitting, all right, what would you do? What Ajahn Gunhar did was amazing. He just lifted up his hand and patted the king cobra on the head. thank you for coming to visit me. Such a long time, just like in the Anger Eating Monster story. Thank you. And he patted King Cobra on the head. Now, of course, it's so rare for a snake to be patted on the head like that, you know, from a nice, kind, compassionate monk. Of course, would that snake was enjoying every moment of that. Such a rare. Do you like have your head patted? Of course, by a great monk. Oh, lovely. Oh, yeah, that's nice. Just put over there. So that snake was enjoying every moment of having his head patted or her head patted. I didn't know what gender it was. You know, I don't know how to distinguish genders in a snake. I don't even want to look. Might disturb it. But anyway, they were patting the head of the snake. And after the snake had enough patting from Ajahn Ganha, he just went down and went to see the next monk. And the next monk, sorry, the snake put his head up, opened its hood, expecting a pat. The next one said, no way. You go back to Ajahn Ganha, I'm not doing that. But that's, you know, that's the true story there. But that's Ajahn Ganha, so it's obviously a very great meditator. And when he would give his teachings of breath meditation, the way he would teach was, you know, people thought it was superficial, but no, this was coming from a very good monk. And he would say, when you breathe in, using a Thai word, sabai, sabai, means really nice and easy and wonderful and relaxed. Breathe in, sabai. Breathe out, sabai. And that was all he would teach. Same again and again and again. Now, what did that mean? It means that when you're breathing in, you add this feeling of joy, relaxation, happiness. Breathe in as joyfully, peacefully, as happily as you can. And breathe out. So nice. Breathe in. Sabah. Breathe out. Sabah. And then you'll find it's very easy to watch the breath. When you're not forcing it, you're not sort of trying to control it, you're just letting it be free to come in and go out just beautifully. You know that you're all saying just how wonderful Bianca is. She's sitting in the backyard. I don't mind praising people, but I like praising people when they're listening, not when they're a long way away. So she's an amazing lady, just how many years she's served this place. But how come the food tastes nice? Because you're cooking the food, adding sabai. Just making the toast, sabai. Making the curries, sabai. Add a lot of sabai into the food. In other words, the kindness, the joy, the love, the oomph you put into things. These days people expect, they feel entitled, they feel expected to get good food, or expected to get good meditation. Expected, but no, you put something into it. You put the sabai into the meditation. And then you find the meditation is just really gets going. So that was Ajahn Ganha's little extra to the breath meditation. Sometimes I like to add a little bit of loving kindness to the breath. And I like metta meditation, compassion, just love to the breath, as well as the happiness, breathing in different ways. And smiling when I'm watching the breath, but also just a bit of kindness there. So you're watching your breath, and I look at my breath just like a little animal, like a baby or a little kitten, or say a teddy bear, So I look at the breath like that and give it this wonderful loving kindness. Combine those two sort of great meditations on loving kindness and on the breath. And I look at the breath like a being. That's one of the reasons. I mean, these are just fur, and I don't know what the filling is. It's just physical stuff. You know, the personality or the kindness, that's what we add to it. But anyway, they can still add, it's easy to add personality. So I wasn't here last night, so whoever sort of tucked my teddy bear in last night after I left, because I found it was actually tucked in under sleep. Like you did, like I was doing. Well done. That little bit of adding a bit of joy, yeah, it's a bit silly. I don't mind being silly. There's three similar types of things. Solitude, of course, being by myself. I love that. Just going in my cave, shutting my door, just being alone. I never feel lonely. I just enjoy just being I was going to say being by myself. I didn't mean that. Being by my no self. Being alone, being just here, enjoying this moment. And that's solitude. When I was over, especially in UK, I don't know how many people would always be saying sorry, 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 sorry. It was my fault. I was talking to someone, I bumped into them. But whoever I bumped into, they didn't do anything wrong, but they're the ones who kept on saying sorry, sorry, sorry. And they didn't do anything wrong. It's weird that why are people so sorry when they're not to blame? And sometimes I call that sorry-tude. And I don't like solitude. So don't live in solitude. Solitude, yes, but not solitude. But my favourite is silitude. A bit of fun, happiness, joy. So anyway, with the metitude, giving loving kindness to... Okay, that's sloth and torpor. Come on. Keep... loving kindness onto the breath. I imagine my breath just like a being, you know, giving it like a personality. And when I look at my breath like any other being, and I'm so kind to it, breath, I care about you. Breath, may you come in and out of my body peacefully. I'm not going to force you. I'm not going to ask you. If you don't feel like coming in, you want to pause for a while, fine. When you want to start breathing again, that's okay by me. Because sometimes, you know, your breath actually just pauses for a while. It's like your body knows you've got enough oxygen. So it just pauses for a while and then it starts again. Sometimes I've noticed in some of the meditations, sometimes, you know, you've obviously been quite peaceful, but the body wants some more energy. And sometimes you take a very deep breath. You're breathing very small then. Just, the body does that. Just, you know, it's saying it needs a bit more oxygen. So I love my breath. I care for it. I let it be. I look upon it with some kind eyes. And that's one of the reasons why the breath stays with me. It's an old friend. Now the metaphor is a metaphor of you go home, wherever your home happens to be, and you get a telephone call from one of your friends. They say, hi, it's me here, and just, are you free this afternoon? You say, yeah. Oh, great. Can you come to this coffee shop? It's my favorite coffee shop. And I want you to try one of these lattes. The lattes there are just so delicious. And I want you to try one of these chocolate chip cookies. And they're also, but I've got diabetes. Now, I want you to talk about some politics, because politics is really important. None of your Buddhist spiritual mumbo jumbo. And I've got 1 hour, so please, we'll be there for 1 hour, because then I've got an appointment afterwards. And we're going to sit in the back where we're not disturbed. Okay? And when somebody, they call you and they tell you where you're going to go, what you're going to drink, what you're going to eat, what you're going to talk about, for how long, that's called a control freak. No one likes to be with them. So you make some excuse, any excuse. So, oh, yeah, I've got to go to the dentist. I'm really, really sorry. I forgot about that. Oh, then maybe next time. And as soon as you hang up, then you're just to keep your precepts, you ring your dentist to make an appointment. And after you made the appointment, another friend rings up and said, hey, you know that sort of tea shop you were talking about, which serves this incredible, delicious tea? And I don't usually like tea, but you know, you said it's such a wonderful shop, so can we go there? And you've always been talking about the biscuits there. The biscuits, the cookies are just to die for. They're just so delicious. And so I don't usually like those sort of stuff, but yeah, can I try, you know, your favourite shop, your favourite food? And even though I'm not a Buddhist or I'm into meditation, you're always talking about how wonderful this is. So you know, come and we'll talk about Buddhism. And sit in the front, because that's where you like to sit. And of course, if somebody invites you to go to your favourite tea shop or coffee shop and to eat what you like to eat and talk about what interests you and just to sit where you like to sit and how you like to sit, of course you say, yeah, I'll be there. You cancel your dentist appointment, which you didn't really need anyway. And you spend all afternoon there. Time just goes by so quickly. And this is a simile with, say, doing breath meditation or any type of meditation. Because sometimes you tell your mind, right, we're going to sit, not on the chairs, we're going to sit on the floor this time, okay? Not where you like to sit, where I want you to sit. I know you just like to do, say, loving kindness meditation, but you're going to do the breath meditation, okay? That's what I want you to do. You're going to do the breath meditation. You're going to do it for 1 hour, not 55 minutes, not an hour and 5 minutes, because that's what I want you to do. You sit down there now. Stop complaining, stop messing about, meditate. You make some excuse. I've got to sort of have a look at the board and to find out what's happening in the evening. I've got to go and help Bianca, I've got to do something. But imagine after doing those little chores, then you come back and ask your mind, what do you want to do? Do you want to meditate, or do you just want to go and sit on the stupa and just watch the trees grow? What do you want to do? And if you're kind and you say, do you want to sit in the hall? You can sit on the chair if you want, or where would you want to sit? And how long for? If you're kind to the mind like that, you can hang around with your mind all afternoon, and the time flies. Have a wonderful time together. Why? Because you're not a control freak. Of course, that explains much about when people come and sit in this hall, why their mind does not comply, why the mind throws a tantrum, why your mind will do anything than watch the breath with you, simply because you're forcing it. So that's why sometimes you tell your mind, you sit up here, what do you want to do now? Your call. Do you want to fall asleep? Okay, fall asleep. Do you want to think about stupid thoughts? Yeah, be my guest. If you treat the mind like that, your mind will say, okay, well, you know, you always say about this breath meditation is really good, so let's give it a try. And you spend all afternoon watching the breath, having a wonderful time, because it's not forced. It's done with kindness, with love. So do you love your mind? My poor old mind, sometimes it does stupid things. Says the same joke again and again and again. That's the nature of my mind. But nevertheless, it's not always the same joke. It reminds me of... Here comes another one. Albert Einstein. Professor Einstein, as we all know, was, you know, a European scholar and physicist, brilliant mind. And so once he started to get a reputation, he was invited to the United States to give a series of lectures. And so there was no aircraft in those days. They put him on a ship. And of course, they didn't know exactly what it looked like. They had a few grainy photographs in the newspapers, but that's all. Just knew he was a genius, revolutionising our ideas about physics. And they arranged a car with a chauffeur to take him from university to university to give a lecture on general theory of relativity. And so the driver picked him up and took him to university after university on the East Coast, where he gave the same lecture again and again and again, to the point that the chauffeur was driving him to yet another Ivy League university to give the same talk. And the chauffeur said, "Professor, I've heard your talk so many times, I think I can give it myself." And Professor I said, "Okay, yeah, you're on. Let's give it a try." So before they got to the next university, they swapped positions. Albert Einstein wearing the chauffeur's jacket and the chauffeur's cap, and the chauffeur, you know, from the Bronx somewhere, was just wearing the tweed jacket and the pipe, messing up his hair a little bit. And they arrived at the next university. And at the next university, of course, the vice-chancellor, you know, all the dignitaries, they opened the back door, and the chauffeur came out pretending to be the great professor. "Oh, Professor Einstein, it's a great honour for you to come to our university." And even though the chauffeur spoke in a New York accent, they didn't sort of understand this was not Professor Einstein. And Professor Einstein, wearing the chauffeur's cap, he just went to have some lunch or some dinner, you know, with the other not important people in the university. And when the lecture was given, the chauffeur, oh, he did such an excellent job. He knew all the stories, all the explanations. He listened to the talk so many times. After he finished the talk, standing ovation, "Wonderful, Professor Einstein." Well, the real Einstein was sitting in the back. And of course, there's always some skeptics in any audience. And this skeptic put his hand up and he said, "Professor Einstein, can I ask you a question?" And this professor at the university asked the great chauffeur, he said, "This really deep question on general theory of relativity." And the chauffeur looked at that question and said, "Professor, that is such a basic question on general relativity. Even my chauffeur sitting in the back can answer that one." And of course, the chauffeur could. Even if I do, I'd say the same questions again and again and again. "I don't know, what did the nun say last night?" Great, here you go. See, so they've heard it many times before. So anyway, where am I going with this? Yeah. So when you are kind to the breath, you have loving kindness to it, you have fun with it, you smile with it, it's easier to engage. So just add that little bit of kindness, opening the door of your heart to this moment. Not just being equanimous, but being happy to be here. That idea of being happy to be here is another way of overcoming just about every possible hindrance there could ever be. Because this was that story of the time when we used to go and teach in prisons. And one of my monks was teaching in this prison. It was a high security jail. And they became very friendly with this monk to the point they asked him to stay behind for a few minutes. I wanted to offer him some cheese and chocolate and a cup of tea and just get to know him more personally. And they asked him, said, "Well, what's it like, life in your monastery? What do you monks do?" And so that's when he told him the story of life in a Buddhist monastery in Australia. "We get up at 4 o'clock in the morning." 4 o'clock, said the prisoners. Even murderers don't have to get up that time. What bad karma did you monks do to have to get up that early? At which point he said, "But it's optional. Getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning is optional in monastery over the road. You can always get up earlier if you want to, just not later. That's the option." "And what about, can you watch the late night movie?"
Oh, we don't have TVs in monasteries. Meditate. Okay. So the prisoners understand. What about your breakfast? When I come here, it's always a treat for my breakfast over here. Over in Bodhinyana Monastery, I have a cup like this, 3 Weetabix and some milk, and that's it. Oh, and a banana maybe, or mango if they're in season, and a cup of tea. That's my breakfast. Wow, they said, in prison, you can get anything you like. You can get vegan sausages. You can get free range, of course. You can... Fair trade. I went into this little very nice little place to rest in London, and they had on the menu sausages. And they're like pork sausages, but they had free range. And I couldn't understand what it meant by free range sausages. I imagine all these sausages walking along crazy, crazy there. Okay, well, and so they can have fried eggs, scrambled eggs, any type of eggs, and you can have sort of muffins, you can have waffles, pancakes, you can have whatever you want there. Porridge, you can have Eastern porridge, Chinese dim sum, whatever you want. I said, wow, what do you do after breakfast? And that's when you see we work. Those of you who walk over there in the mornings will see the monks working. Sometimes hard physical labour. And I used to love doing that in the old days, but you won't let me do that anymore. Honestly, you won't. The thing I mentioned the last time I was fixing, there was some plumbing on top of the teacher's cottage. And so I was taking some of the roof sheets off. And somebody saw me, the previous caretakers, and they took a photograph of me and put it on their website. They shouldn't have done that, because they said, Ajahn Brahm, no, don't do that ever again. Why not? Said, well, you might fall off. You know, you're too valuable to fall off. And anyway, we're not quite sure whether the rafters can hold your weight. I said, that's not very nice. So that was the end of that work. But anyway, I used to love doing the concrete work. And I was one day just with building a hut, and you know, I said we do a lot of work ourselves here. Building a hut, and it's like a, you might call it like a boy thing. It's making concrete, shoveling up here, pushing the wheelbarrows along. It's really good fun. But of course you get all sort of splattered with the concrete. So I was fully splattered, you know, on my face, on my robes everywhere, and just going off to go to the, take a shower. And that was when we had a visitor. Unfortunately, I'm just too well known, and this was a Sri Lankan girl. And please excuse me for this whole story, but that I could hear her coming a long way away. I thought it was the ice cream truck. She had so many bangles on her, and they were jingling all over the place. Now, you don't usually, you know, Sri Lankans in Perth are just, you know, much more restrained, you know, but this was somebody, you know, she was high class, I think, showing off. And so in a really expensive sari, lots of bangles, and, you know, we're about to cross the path, and he said, oh, I'm looking for Ajahn Brahm. Do you know where Ajahn Brahm is? And I had the sense to say, you know, not that I was Ajahn Brahm, because I was really looking a mess, more of a mess than I usually do. And so I said, if you go to the Dhanasala where we have our lunch, he'll probably be there in a few minutes. So off she went, and I quickly had a shower, changed my robes into clean shower, just made myself look presentable, sort of. And then I went to present myself. And so I gave a nice little discussion, said, oh yeah, you're a good monk, it's a great monastery, it's so peaceful here, except for one thing, she said. On the way here, I met one of your monks. And he looked a mess, splattered all over with grey stuff. You should not allow that in this monastery. And I said, and I was honest, I didn't break my precepts. I said, oh, really, madam, I'll talk to him later about it.
She never realised it was me.
It's amazing people's perception, because they have these ideas of what a person is. And they see that dirt all over you, and they think that can't be the boss of the monastery. But they see you nice and sort of sitting down and just friendly, nicely dressed, and they think, oh, that must be the boss. So anyway, we did a lot of work, and then, oh crikey. And then what happened next? I have to do this pretty quickly. What about lunch? Lunch over there in a bowl. Everything gets in on top of each other. And it was not that long ago. Strawberry ice cream on spaghetti. It's delicious. Have you ever tried it? Actually, it's not. It's terrible. Because you put it all in a bowl, you try and separate it out, you know, ice cream here, spaghetti there, curry over here. But then sometimes people take it upstairs and maybe they're not that careful and it just gets shaken about. And by the time all the other monks come up, there's ice cream in there, it's all just melted all over the place, you know, in your curry. And the prisoners, were they disgusted by that? They said, look, even in solitary confinement, they give you a little tray with little compartments on. So what do you do after lunch? Well, that's actually when we said, you know, can you play sport? You know, can you sort of play again like soccer? And I really literally did think about doing that when I first came here. Because, you know, we wanted to make contact with people from other religions. Or, you know, even this the Vajrayanas over here, you know, we got to know them pretty well. But how about having like a football match? Theravada versus Mahayana. Of course, you'd know who would win. If it's really Mahayana, they would be the bodhisattvas. They would let go. They would let us win. But that just would not work because, you know, I'm not really into winning. That's a problem. So, into losing. Be a loser. Sometimes people come up to me and say, look, you know, you had a really good degree, you're a smart fellow, and this is where you've ended up. You've got no pension, no superannuation, no assets. You just live in a small hut. You have to beg for your food every day. Ah, you're just a loser. Sadhu. You got me in one. I'm a loser. It's great being a loser. If you're a winner, then you have to compete again the next year or the next competition. But being a loser, that's wonderful. You're free. I get into trouble with parents because I tell the children, I said, look, you've got exams coming up. Fail them. Because if you pass, you've got to do another one next year or next couple of years' time. And you have to keep doing exams until you finally fail one, and then you're free. So I get in big trouble that way. But there's a lot of truth to that. So being a loser means you're free, you don't have many possessions, nothing to live up to, no expectations. Different way of looking at life. Free. And I said the other day, instead of fear of missing out, apparently that's a word, FOMO, which drives your children, the fear of missing out. It's not fear of missing out, it's the freedom of missing out. That's what FOMO means, the freedom of missing out. Wonderful. Be different. Anyway, I'm a loser. And they have a TV program, The Biggest Loser. Never seen it. But I know who the biggest loser is. Who's the biggest loser? The Buddha. He lost everything. Lost the whole of samsara. So happy, the least he had. So, when you meditate, we meditate to get lost. To be a loser. And lose your sense of being. Lose your past. Lose your future. Wouldn't it be a wonderful thing to be? There's only one problem with that. Apparently that I was teaching, I was in Singapore, a conference on Buddhism and dementia. And when the professor from the university, the expert on dementia, started saying the signs of dementia are not being able to remember the past, not being able to plan for the future, and being socially disengaged. And I thought, uh-oh. That's what I'm teaching each one of you on this retreat. Not to speak to one another, no more silence, be in solitude, forget about the past, don't plan for the future. I'm the cause of dementia. And of course there's something else going on that's not really dementia. So anyway, so just in the afternoon, now we just meditate. I said, oh, crikey. I said, what time do you have dinner? Dinner? We don't have dinner as much. Well, they don't feed you in the afternoon at 6 o'clock at dinner time. No, what about supper? No, what about midnight snacks? No. Oh, in prison we can eat any old time. Wow, they said, that's terrible. So what do you do in the evening? Can you play cards? Play poker? That's the other little story. There was there was this rabbi, this Catholic priest, and a Buddhist monk. The rabbi, the priest, and the monk, they decided they couldn't play soccer together, so they decided, you know, instead of just having lunches together, you know, they wanted to do something a bit more interactive. So they decided to play cards together. And they're playing cards, and if you don't have something to make it more interesting, so they're playing poker, you know, for cash. They were gambling. And of course, in that particular jurisdiction, it was illegal. So someone led on that this priest, this rabbi and a monk were gambling. So they called the police, and they got the three of them arrested. It was against the law. So the three appeared in court, and the magistrate asked the priest, first of all, were you gambling? Listen, just cut to the chase, let's not mess around. You're a man of the cloth, you're supposed to be virtuous. Were you gambling? And the priest, as quickly, even faster than the judge could see, he looked up and said, Jesus, forgive me, put his head down and said, no. And the rabbi was next and said, Rabbi, were you gambling? And the rabbi did believe in Jesus, obviously, so he couldn't put his head up and ask for forgiveness. Instead, he did the old trick which I did at school. You put your fingers behind your back and cross them. Because they said, no, 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 gambling, no, no. Okay, now the monk. And the judge has seen the hand go behind his back, so suspected of some funny business. So, monk, put your hands in the front. And you don't believe in Jesus, so you can't look up to heaven. Were you gambling? And the monk said, with whom? So anyway. So what time is it? Oh my goodness. So anyway. So we don't play cards, we just meditate. Anyway, to get to the punchline of this story, what time do you go to bed? Bed? I sleep on the floor. Some of you have been to my cave? Okay, well, I'm not there at the moment, so you can go any old time and have a look in there. And you see, that's where I live, that's where I spend most of my time. Just, it's got a little mat on the floor, and I sleep on the floor. Very comfortable. One of the reasons I sleep on the floor is, somebody showed me this article. There were people getting killed by being eaten by sharks, you know, tourists in Western Australia. And somebody actually was saying, just how many people are actually killed by shark attacks in Australia? And there are more people killed by falling out of bed. And they said this, it was true, the statistics. More people killed by falling out of bed than by eaten by sharks. So because of that, I made sure I sleep on the floor. So that's not going to kill me. I could roll out of bed and I don't fall any distance at all, maybe an inch, that's it. So anyway, so we don't go to bed, just sleep on the floor. And when the prisoners heard that this is how monks live, and in prison have these beautiful beds, they got TVs, they got probably just 64 channels, they've got I don't know how much else there, and lots of food, they can play all sorts of stuff. And they said, wow, we didn't realize how austere and ascetic it is in a Buddhist monastery. They said, that's terrible in your monastery, they said. Why don't you come in here and stay with us instead? One of the prisoners actually said that, forgetting where they were. But they had a point. Inside prison, it's much more comfortable than living in Bodhinyana Monastery as a monk. To the point that if somehow or other I got accused, I'm a good monk, if I got accused of something I didn't do and I got sentenced to jail, yeah, I wouldn't have to lead any retreats. Nobody asking me any questions. Wouldn't have to travel overseas. I'd just be able to meditate all day. And if I wanted a retreat, punch a prison officer in the nose, compassionately, of course. And then I get a couple of months solitary. And it's hard enough for me to get 2 weeks solitary in this place. Would that be a good idea?
No, shouldn't he say?
So anyway, but then I started, the reason I tell this story is not just because it's a joke, because there's something serious in this. Why is it that in Bodhinyana Monastery as well as Dhammasara Monastery, there's a waiting list? A waiting list of people trying to get in. In prison, there's a waiting list of people trying to get out, even though it's more comfortable. What is the essential difference between a monastery and a prison? In a monastery, people want to be there. In a prison, they want to be somewhere else. And as soon as I figure that one out, this is where it opens up huge amounts of insight. Do you want to be here? Or do you want to go off to the toilet? Are you hanging out for lunch? Are you counting the days? How many more days until this retreat is finished? If you don't want to be here, you've just created a prison. If you're in a relationship you don't like, your relationship is a prison for you. If you're in a job, you hate going to work in that every morning. The job is a prison. You don't want to be there. Or if you're in a meditation and it's not going according to your wishes, you don't want to be here. You want to be in Nimitta land or jhanas or anywhere because you're so restless. If you don't want to be here, you're in prison. You have no freedom at all. The way to escape from the prisons of life and to experience freedom is your partner, I don't know who they are, but they're good enough. They may not be the best guy in the world, the best girl in the world, but you try and swap them and they'll probably be the same again. So, people, different chassis, same models, underneath, same engines underneath. So it's a waste of time trying to change. Instead, be with the one. Change your attitude rather than change the object. Your job? Do you get a salary when you go to work? That's a bribe to make you do something you'd rather not do. So your job is good enough. Pays the bills. If you're happy to be here, then you feel a lot of freedom. In meditation, you may be tired. You may be restless. Are you happy to be here? Or do you want to go somewhere else? If you're happy to be here, it's called freedom. You're letting go of wanting. You're kind to this moment. And then you find there's no wanting. And the mind gets so peaceful very quickly.
So during the meditations, whether you're watching the breath, whether you're tired, when you go to bed at night and you can't sleep, do you want to go to sleep or just want to be here right now with this insomniac mind? If you really change your attitude, you want to be here. All the problems vanish. You're free. And when you're dying, which eventually we will all do you want to be here on this process towards the end of your life? Or do you want to be somewhere else? Every time you want to be somewhere else, you create that tightness, that tension called suffering. Suffering is wanting to be somewhere else. Suffering is the distance from where you are to where you want to be. So sometimes instead of trying to get where you want to be, make where you want to be where you are. Happy to be here. And then you are free. Sadhu. 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 Very good.